Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back to Raised by Giants, where we talk all things spirituality. I'm Ryder Lee. Tonight we have returning guest, military intelligence officer and security specialist for the DOD and current director of the Oxford Paranormal Society, Trey Hudson, speaking about high strangeness at the Meadow Project, unseen reality, grill flame, and much more. But before I introduce him, check out Raised by Giants on Rockfin. It is a completely uncensored platform. Go over there, set up a free account, get all of my regular content I post here on YouTube, and sign up for Rockfin's premium content, which is far less than a YouTube premium account, at only $10 a month. And you'll get all of my premium uncensored content when it gets released, and all of the other creators' premium content as well, like Beyond Classified, Charlie Robinson, Jay Dyer, Zero with Sam Tripoli, Tinfoil Hat, Eddie Bravo, and Rex Bear Leak Project, and much more. Check the link in the description to sign up for the video streaming platform, Rockfin. Also, check out C60 Purple Power. It is the most powerful antioxidant on the planet. Helps with energy levels, skin problems, infections, eyesight, brain cognition, EMF radiation, and a lot more. It's a free radical sponge that gives your body the ability to heal itself. And if you use promo code GIANTS10 from the link in the description, you'll get 10% off your entire purchase. I highly recommend it. I've been using it for over a year with my own money, and I wouldn't recommend something that doesn't work. Hello and welcome back to the show, Trey. Thanks so much for coming back on. I really appreciate you. It's been a while since you were first on, but how have you been, my friend?
I've been good. Yeah, busy. Life's just rolling on like everything else, keeping me out of trouble or perhaps putting me into trouble. It depends on how you look at it, but all is well. All is well.
Good. I'm really happy to hear that. And we first met at the Laughlin UFO MegaCon a couple of years ago. I think they've canceled that a couple of years in a row now, unfortunately.
Yeah. That was a good time. A lot of really neat people there. And it's really cool because like yourself, you and I became friends there, and I'm still very good friends with a lot of the attendees and fellow presenters that I met there. So that was quite the experience. Absolutely.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Hopefully they started back up because, there was a lot of interesting people there. Some of them, kind of whatever, I think, full of crap, but you're going to have that in any, topic or any discussion. And no matter what you're talking about in the paranormal field, the Bigfoot field, UFO field, there's going to be nonsense bullshit in there, unfortunately. But I wanted to kind of bring you back on to get a little bit of an update on the Meadows project. Have you been back there since we last spoke?
Oh, many times. Been back there many times. Most recently is October, and we're actually planning an outing in about 3 weeks. So we've been out there quite a bit. Just had a tremendous amount of experiences. And the weird thing is the experiences and the phenomena is evolving, which is really interesting because not too long ago, a book came out called Skinwalkers in the Pentagon. And it was some of the information and stuff that NIDS was capturing on the behalf of DIA was starting to come out. And it's really weird because some of their experiences are mirroring, you know, some of the evolution of the experiences and phenomena we're having out at the Meadow.
Yeah, I really liked your presentation at the Laughlin UFO MegaCon because, you know, you had proof of what you were talking about and what you're saying, and you were presenting in, and you were showing the portals, you were showing the two entities, you're showing the supposed UAP that was there on the Meadows. So just for a refresher for the audience that might not have watched our previous interview, could you give a little bit of an idea of what the Meadows is briefly?
Sure. Yeah, the Meadow, and I want to paint a picture for, you know, people in their mind, is I want them to imagine a mountain field or a meadow somewhere in the Appalachian section of the United States, here in the Southland. Very pristine, very beautiful, you know, just a really nice, quiet and serene place that holds just beneath the veneer of normalcy. There's this oddness that lurks below. My team had discovered it quite by accident. We were actually doing some Bigfoot research and paranormal research on a supposed haunted road, you know, a place that, you know, the locals said, you don't go down there at night, the paints will get you, you know, as they articulated their, you know, their opinions of their missing teeth and all of that. So, of course, you know, don't go to a haunted road. That's where I'm going, obviously. So the haunted road thing turned out to be a bust. You know, there wasn't a whole lot going on. And we returned to our base camp, defeated and, you know, rejected and somewhat deflated by our lack of activity. But while we were there, one of our team members had a pretty remarkable UAP experience where he saw a beam of light and he saw an orb appear, you know, a big circular light in the sky that moved sideways, and then a small black dot appeared in it and eventually covered the entire orb and winked out. He also saw orbs up on top of a ridgeline adjacent to this base camp. So we decided, I forget this haunted road jazz, you know, that's not a good use of our time. We're going to start exploring and experimenting in this area. And we found just about a quarter of a mile, half a mile from base camp, this meadow, this field. And we were going to start using that as a basis for our research and investigation for several reasons. Number one, it's a big open field. If something moves across it, because this area has a history of Sasquatch sightings, you can see a track line. Okay, that's number one. Number two is at night, you can put people in the field with a FLIR, you know, thermals and night vision, and they can see anything moving around. Thing number three is it has a ridge to the south of it that people can actually, to the north of it, where people can actually see what's going on down below. So you can put a team up there to watch what's going down below if anything moves into it. And the fourth option is it's open. You can see the sky. So we thought this would be a really cool place to do our investigations. Well, during our investigations, which started back in 2016, so we've been doing this quite a few years, we've had everything from missing time, UAPs. We had these cubes form. And thing about the cubes is I'm finding that the cube structure is more and more prevalent in areas of high strangeness. I just watched David Pilates' recent documentary, the UFO Missing 411, the UFO Connection.
Oh, you got to see the new one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. Was it really good?
It was good. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
I didn't know that it was out yet.
Yeah, it was out. It's, you know, I had to buy it on Amazon Prime, but
oh man, I'm gonna go watch that tonight. Then I didn't realize that was out. I'm really interested in that because I really love his documentary. He's very interesting.
Well, what you're gonna find interesting in your audience, if they've seen it or if they do watch it, something to watch for is near the end of the documentary. There's a review of a case that happened in Oxbow National Forest in Wyoming, I believe, and I could be getting that wrong, but it is a gentleman by the name of Higdon, and he saw in the forest a cube or a box, and when they showed the recreation of this thing that he saw, the thump people probably heard about 3 weeks ago was my jaw hitting the floor. It was exactly what my team encountered in the meadow. It was a translucent cube, except his was visual. Ours was on FLIR. And what was really interesting about our cube is as it dissipated, we sent a team into the area where it was, you know, the area where the cube had previously been. And they completely disappeared off of our thermals. Their heat signatures disappeared. It's almost as though they walked into something. And it's interesting now hearing about Higdon's experience, as he actually described it as a craft, as something you could step into. And we have this on video, my team disappearing off of our thermals. We've tried to recreate it. We have not been successful in recreating what we saw. Like I said, we had missing times. We had an individual that we were watching through thermal turn into a ball of energy, travel, you know, a couple hundred feet, turn back into a man-sized heat signature. And from his perspective, nothing weird happened. He was just walking, you know, through the meadow. From the perspective of the observers, he was turned into a ball of energy. And the cool thing about that is we can get down into the quantum nature of it. He was in two states at once. He was a ball of energy, and he was just a dude walking through the field. So it's kind of like light in the dual slit experiment. It exists both as a wave and as a particle. So, you know, you start to see some macro, that's kind of a misnomer, macro quantum effects in this particular field. We've had disembodied voices, as you mentioned before, UAPs. And since then, we've had even crazier stuff than that going on. So it's just basically one of those places that is just so bizarre that a lot of people call it the Skinwalker Ranch of the South. It has, you know, that entire myriad of strangeness going on at this particular location.
Now, you sent me the video of your team walking through the portal, and I also saw that video at the conference as well. Now, for someone that is skeptical that would be watching this, they would probably say that the team just went out of view of the thermal imaging camera, right?
Yeah.
So how far, because you know this technology more than anyone, you use it all the time. How far does this thermal imaging camera pick up a heat signature from the point from where you're recording?
Yeah, a couple of factors come into play. One is, of course, distance. You know, the further something is away, the more difficult it is to detect. Another thing is the size of the object. The smaller object is harder to detect than a larger object. And the third thing, of course, is the differentiation of heat between the background and the object. So what we did, and that's a very fair criticism, and I get it, you know. So what we did is we went to the exact same place during the almost the exact time of year. We were about 2 weeks off of when this happened. And what we did is set up a thermal camera and then also set up a regular video camera, both recording at the same time. And we had a team traverse the same area where they had disappeared. Now, what's interesting is this was done during the day. So the ambient air temperature was a lot closer to the heat of the subjects. During the original cube video or portal video, it was at nighttime. So there was a greater difference. So the likelihood of a team disappearing from thermal would be during the day when you have a much closer or smaller variance in heat. So we put the team out there. We had them walk the same route. And what was amazing was at no time, even when they went behind heavy vegetation, you could still see elements of their heat signature. It didn't completely disappear. And with the vegetation gone, because this was in the wintertime, you could see all the way across the field, over this creek and up a ridge. There was no vegetation. So the likelihood of somebody or two people being able to completely hide their heat signatures from our thermals is almost non-existent. And we've tried to recreate it, and we just cannot come up with a way, you know, using that regular terrain and vegetation to hide from our thermals. You know, of course, we could put up some sort of heat barrier or thermal blanket or something and, you know, shield it that way, but, you know, those just weren't present, you know, at the time of the sighting.
Now, the video of the two beings that you sent me that I also seen before as well, where your was your team accounted for at that time?
They were all accounted for? Absolutely. That's one of the things that we do is we run our operations kind of like a military operation. Not that we're paramilitary, we're not, but a lot of our members are prior service. So that's kind of an operational template we understand. So, you know, some of the things we do is we have a operational commander. That's a person that's over the entire expedition for however many days. And they see to meeting all the experimental objectives, the safety of the crew and all of that. They're the operational commander. Then you have a tactical commander. And they're the person that are actually responsible for the operations in the field. The operational commander, a lot of times will stay back at base camp. Tactical commander will be out in the field. We also have a net control operator, a radio control operator. He controls the communications back and forth between the command and the teams. Part of that is that nobody, before we go out, everybody's briefed. Everybody knows what their mission is, what their assignment is, what equipment they need to take with them, and what the objective is for the evening of the day. Second thing is once they get on site, they get on objective, they stay there. They don't move unless they get permission from the tactical commander. That way we have accountability of all teams and we always know where they are. So the entities that we film were not team members because there were no team members at that area because we were actually up on top of the ridge I talked about earlier looking down. We had seen thermal signatures of several deer a few moments before. These obviously were not deer. And we can't explain these thermal signatures for two reasons. Number one, no human beings were there that we are aware of. And the thing splits. It changes sizes. It turns into two and then back morphs back into one. So, you know, we really have no explanation for what we saw other than, you know, it was a man-sized heat signature, you know, 2 meters tall, meter wide, more or less, shrink down to about 1 meter, back up to 2 meters, and then split into two.
Yeah, so that footage is really, really interesting. Now, the UAP footage that you sent me, I found this really interesting because it seems like they were blinking. Like they were putting off some kind of light source in the video, of course. Now, was the person or the person of your team, were they seeing this with their own eyes, or was this only captured through the FLIR?
I shot that video myself. Now, what we were using is, of course, Mark I eyeballs, you know, just using regular, you know, eyeballs. And we were also using a Psionics digital night vision camera. So that was shot, you know, with the Psionics. And I'll tell you exactly what I saw that evening is we were sitting there doing a sky watch at a lake that's about maybe 2 or 3 miles from the meadow. You know, and this is an area of high strangers, not just a really tight location. So, you know, I was sitting there. We were watching the sky, watching the bank next to this lake or the shoreline. And I saw a blinking light. And the first thing that popped into my mind is, when did they put up a radio antenna, you know, in this area? I don't remember one ever being here before. And I've been to this area many, many times. And then I look, you know, it's at about 12 o'clock. And then I look down to about maybe 8 o'clock and there's another blinking light. And I'm like, this is very odd. So I move the field of view of my night vision camera up to capture these two blinking lights. I have some binoculars, some 10X binoculars. I bring those up. And what I see in the binoculars are two sets of lights blinking on and off, on and off. And then down here below it are two lights blinking on and off, on and off. And what's odd about it is the lights start off high in the sky and very slowly. They're almost stationary. You really have to watch this for a while to see that they're actually moving. They move below the horizon. Now, an aircraft will start below the horizon, come above the horizon, and then drop down behind you. This started high in the horizon and then went down. We had seen aircraft all through the sky that evening. Some of the things you look for, you know, on aircraft, I'm also a MUFON field investigator, is the red and green navigation lights on the tips of the wings. you look for the anti-collision beacons on the underside and upper side of the aircraft that rotate red. You also look for other lighting, and it's pretty distinctive. These are required navigational lights for aircraft. We have seen those all through the evening. These two objects did not have that lighting pattern. All they had were two lights together blinking. And the odd thing is they were blinking in together. They were almost like they were tethered together, blinking. These two separate sets of light were synchronized. So I went back, pulled up a program called FR-24, Flight Radar 24, went back to the historical time because I recorded the time this took happened. I recorded the lat long of where I was at. I shot an azimuth with a compass, so I knew exactly where I saw these lights. I counted how many degrees they were above the horizon. So I had a really good recollection of exactly where this happened and where they were in relation to my point on the ground. I could find no record of aircraft in that vicinity at that time, nor could I find a record of an airport where you would have aircraft either approaching for landing or taking off. So, when you exhaust all other options, it's an unexplained aerial phenomenon. But it falls into line because that area does have a history of UAPs.
Yeah, it's really interesting that whenever we went out for our Skywatch at it was me, you, and another gentleman. I can't remember his name from your team. Chris Matthew.
Bob Wilson.
Bob Wilson. Yes. Yes. Thank you. The gentleman there, I think his name was Michael Sedona or whatever that was running that Skywatch. He basically said, which I don't know how much truth there is to it, because I'm not a UFO expert. I'm, interested in it and I find it fascinating. But he says that
with Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to, has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
If you remember during that Skywatch, he said that anything that's blinking is normally some sort of man-made structure and isn't necessarily could be considered a extraterrestrial craft or an ET craft or something like that. And I just found that interesting. That point there, which I'm absolutely, and I have no idea. I don't really know. I haven't really looked into it, but have you witnessed anything else with, your eyes, like your 3D physical eyes that you also captured on camera?
Let's see. We did have, this was captured on camera, but it was visual, is back in 2016. We had some, 2017, we had some guest researchers come and visit us from the Carolinas. And I'd taken them out to the meadow and I was giving a briefing, in the meadow saying, this is where this happened. This is where we usually set up, blah, blah, blah. And I had three photographers with me. And in one of the stills, and we didn't notice this until the next year, 2018, when we were reviewing these photographs, in the background, there appears to be a hominid standing at the woodline watching us. And you can look at it, you can see its brow ridge and its shoulders and all. And which is kind of cool because this area has a very rich, like I talked about, a very rich Sasquatch history. We have also seen cryptids watching our campsite at night, like looking around a tree and in Bigfoot the Bigfoot world is they call those tree peepers. You know, they actually peep, you know, around a tree. So that's pretty common. And, you know, what's really cool is this, you know, area has, you know, all of the, and I'm going to use a term that probably sounds kind of silly, normal high strangeness events, which is, you know, an oxymoron, but you know, you have UAPs, you have cryptids, you have, you know, entities, which people, you know, would interpret it as ghost or whatever. But then we started having other things that's really weird. We started having disembodied voices. You know, people would hear things like these terms, like, and I don't know if you're familiar with Jessica Jones on Spaced Out Radio. She's one of my team members. She heard time travel. She heard the term just as plain as day. We had another team member when we were back at base camp that heard almost like a synthesized robotic voice coming from about 20 feet away where there was nobody. And we've had people's vehicles lock and unlock. We've had some very odd radiation spikes. And this is where it starts to get really interesting. And in my book, and I believe I was talked about it at the conference you were at, is I talk about these little tiny micro, wee little spikes of radiation when we had incidents of high strangeness. Later on, I don't know if it was that year or the next year, on the TV show, The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch, what are they talking about? Little radiation spikes and about the same degree that I was talking about, 0.06 microsieverts per hour, spiking to about 0.12 microsieverts per hour. But we had an incident that was really, really weird. It involved radiation, Stephen Greer CE5 protocol, and a download. Is we had set up a camp one evening at a different campsite. This was during COVID. And the main camp that we used was shut down by the Department of Natural Resources because it was a more established camp. So we went to a primitive camp that wasn't really controlled so much by them. So we were set up in this very remote camp, and we decided we were, since many of my team are trained remote viewers, we were going to go out and use Stephen Greer's CE5 protocol. Whether or not people agree with him or not, that's beside the point. The idea of projecting intent is well known to yield results sometimes. So we decided we were going to try that. So we got out there. You know, we're projecting intent. We got ourselves in the right frame of mind, and nothing happened. Doodly, you know, skunked again, doggone it. So we get back to camp, and Bob, who you met, said, I had something really weird happen. He said, I'm sitting here at camp, and this particular campsite was probably about 40 yards, 40 meters off of a chert or gravel road. County road through this natural wildlife preserve. And anybody that's been in the country or been in a rural area knows that a vehicle makes a very distinct sound driving over a gravel road. It's like a crunchy, crispy kind of sound as it, you know, travels down the road. Well, he's sitting in base camp and he hears what he thinks is a vehicle driving across the gravel road 40 meters from our base camp. So he extinguishes his lantern, blacks out the camp, and he's sitting there waiting to see a vehicle drive by. No vehicle drives by, but he hears the sound of it move by. Now, in this particular place, it's so remote that you don't even have cell phone coverage. That's how remote it is. And it is pitch black at night. And unless you have, you know, something like this, Gen 3 night vision, and you're driving down the road at night, you're not going to be able to do it. So something that was blacked out or wasn't visible moved past our campsite. He was also running his Geiger counter. And when this craft or vessel, because that's about the only term I can use, because I don't know what it was, when it passed by the camp, he had a radiation spike that went from about 0.06 microsieverts per hour, and it spiked up to 0.6 microsieverts per hour. So 10 times an increase when this thing passed by. So he also heard like a voice out in the forest, like a woman's voice where there shouldn't be one. So once again, disembodied voices. He took his thermal scanned, didn't see anybody.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you bring up the voices and robotic voices, because I investigated a place in Kentucky way back a really long time ago with one of my friends, and we're going to be making a documentary out of this house. And a gentleman that lived there, he came and gave us his testimony, and he said that he heard robotic voices. He described it as sounding like Metatron, mm-hmm. like from Transformers. It sounded like Metatron. Right. And this voice was, according to him in his testimony, was telling him to kill his family. And then whenever he wouldn't do that, the voices told him to kill himself. And there was actual bullet holes where he had the gun in his hand and had it to his head. And he fired 3 bullet holes in the bathroom of this house, and the bullet holes were all still there. Have you experienced anything threatening or harmful at
no.
the Meadows?
No, not like that. That night after we did the CE5 protocol, one of my team members, who's his background, he's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, has a degree in engineering, spent time in U.S. Air Force Special Operations, and is now an expert in his field and goes all over the world doing what he does. He came to me the next morning, which was Sunday, and he said, "Hey, Trey," he goes, "I had something weird happen to me after we got back in base camp." Well, you know, I mean, weird is kind of our forte in this place. That's nothing unusual. But I said, "Tony, you know, what happened?" And he said, "You know, I woke up about 4:30 in the morning, 4:30. And I had this term pop into my mind, these words." And he said, the words were Nox Magbe, NOXMABE, spelled phonetically. And he said, "And I woke up again at 06:30 with these same words just popped into my mind. Does it mean anything?" And I'm like, "Well, no, it doesn't mean anything to me, but I can research it. You know, thanks for letting me know." So I took out my pocket notebook and I wrote down the phonetics of it and all, and went back and researched it. Well, I found out that the word Nox, N-O-X, is a variation of the Greek word Nyx. And in both Greek and Roman mythology, Nyx, and later Nox, was the goddess of the night goddess. Magbe turned out to be a little bit more difficult. So I did a lot of research on this, and I found in the old English poem Beowulf, the term Magba, which means kindred or children. So Nox Magba. So we put those together and you get, let me back up. The Latin, Nox, in Old English are contemporaneous, because when Old English was spoken, that was right after the Romans had left Britain. And it was the beginning of the Dark Ages. So it's conceivable that the two terms would be used at the same time. So they were contemporaneous. So you put the two terms together and you have children of the night goddess. Now, keeping in mind what we were doing, trying to make contact, what comes into people's rooms at night that are small like children and have big heads like children? The grays. So, you know, one could conclude that that was a download, that we did make contact, and that was their way of acknowledging our effort.
Sounds really similar to James Peniston and the Rendlesham Forest incident, where he touched the pyramid, supposed pyramid UFO, and then he got all of those numbers and everything, and he was constantly dreaming about it. And then I'm not too sure what came of that, or if I think he wrote a book or something about it, and he kind of figured it out more. But yeah, that's really interesting. Now, the radiation aspect of this, because I found that interesting as well. And I've had Ryan Burns on my show. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with Ryan Burns.
Ryan.
I'm on my show quite a few times. And he encountered a cattle mutilation. And he got a lot of radiation off of that cattle mutilation. And it made him sick. And I think he had problems with his leg or his arm or something like that. So have you guys had any problems from any of the radiation? Has the radiation made you sick at all? Any elements?
No, the radiation that we encounter is very light, very, you know, just a fudge above background radiation. And none of us have gotten sick, but from radiation. But we have had people get sick. We've had one team member die. You know, after we started investigating, you know, he became sick. We never really found out exactly what it was, but he died unexpectedly, which was really sad. He was a good friend and a really fantastic team member. He was our physicist. And we've had another team member's stage 4 cancer come back, and he's fighting that battle right now. We've had another team member come down with very severe respiratory issues. And we've had a team member that actually had to be medevaced out of the camp at night because of heart palpitations that were so severe. He had to be medevaced. So, you know, it's important that I say this, because I would be negligent if I did. There is a certain danger to this stuff. And now that it's actually starting to be explored by people like Dr. Gary Nolan, you know, who's looking at people who have had experiences of high strangeness with UAPs and other craft, doing MRIs of their brains and finding things that look like MS lesions, multiple sclerosis lesions in their brains. So there is a medical and physical potential for change to your body when you encounter this high strangeness. So that's something that I've talked to a very well-known neuroradiologist about some of this stuff. And I sent him some information from some various cases for him to look at. And also the DOD, in one of their, either the latest or the one before that release, actually talked about some physiological changes of pilots and aviators that have come in close contact with UAPs. Now that goes right back to, you know, you were referring to Rendlesham Forest. Exactly the same thing is, physical changes, the Cash Lundrum case. Physical changes, radiation burns. I have another team member that was in the Great Smoky Mountains, which is not where the meadow is, but he was in the Great Smoky Mountains, had an experience. He had family members inside of a vehicle that did not have the experience or did not experience any illness. He was outside of the vehicle. He had started coming down with issues where his body wasn't making white blood cells. You know, and he was very sick and had to have quite a few transfusions, and the doctors are baffled. It wasn't leukemia, but it was something happened to his body while he was experiencing a situation of high strangeness. And if you'll bear with me, do you remember Katie Page, who was at the conference and talked about the Colorado Ranch?
I believe so. She was talking about cattle mutilations, correct?
Yep. She was talking about cattle mutilations, and I have the report here, and I'm going to see if I can find it in here. It was, she also encountered at this ranch boxes or cubes, which were very, very prevalent. And I'm trying to find the disembodied voice that they heard. And I might not be able to find this in the report. I didn't mark it. But they had a disembodied voice telling them to not report their experience and to keep it to themselves, which once again is another disembodied voice communicating in an area of high strangeness. So it seems to be pretty common, along with the boxes and cubes. I'm finding these boxes and cubes to be, you know, almost like an archetype, you know, among some of these various sites.
Yeah, I believe that I asked her a question that I don't think people really liked from the audience, because most of her presentation was all about cattle mutilations. And I think I was the last one to come up and ask a question to her. And I asked her about human mutilations, right? Because people want to talk about, you know, cattle and all that, but, you know, and they can kind of, you know, be like, oh, well, you know, because cattle is one thing. Right. Animals is one thing. Doing that to animals is one thing, but doing it to a human is a completely different thing.
Strange you should mention that. That's one of my areas of research. And this is actually a case out of Brazil of human mutilation. So that's not unheard of. which is kind of horrifying. That's friggin' awful, you know, when you think about it. But there's a pretty well-known case in Brazil where, and I'm going to just read it, if you don't mind, since you went down that rabbit hole, and I just happen to have this.
Let's do it.
Okay, it's talked about the body was in perfect condition. The flesh and lips have been excised from around the mandibles, which is means the lower mid-face was taken off. No signs of animal predation or putrefaction. No odor from the cadaver. And this was, like I said, in Brazil. Let's see, eyes and ears were also removed. The mouth cavity was emptied. Removal of extensive tissues around the face and head. One of the ears was removed. The anus was removed. Intestines were removed. The entire cadaver was sunken in. And, you know, if people have a strong stomach, and I'm, oh, and there were also dimes or quarter, let me back up, silver dollar size holes in different places on the body, you know, like almost where it was excised out. And if people are, you know, brave enough to take a look at that, you can look up the Brazilian human mutilation case. It's really fascinating and kind of horrifying. There's also a case that, oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that it is really interesting that it's kind of the human mutilation cases have kind of been covered up by cattle mutilations. Like they don't want to talk about human mutilations, but I'm all about talking about things that people don't want to talk about. But explain the next one that you're about to talk about.
Yeah, the next one was supposedly, and Project Grudge was the predecessor to Project Blue Book, and there were a series of Project Grudge reports, and there's a rumor of something called Project Grudge Report 13. And in this report, it talks about a case called the Lovett Cunningham case. And it has to do with, and I'm looking at my notes right here. It happened with White Sands Missile Base. It was Sergeant Jonathan Lovett, who was assisting a Major William Cunningham at the White Sands Missile Base near Holman Air Force Base in New Mexico. And what they were searching for were scattered debris from a rocket test. And this was in probably in the 50s. And supposedly while they were looking for this debris, the major heard Lovett scream. And so he thought that he had been bitten by a snake, and anybody that's been out in that part of the country, you know, you have snakes that hide up under rock and stuff. And so Cunningham went to look for Lovett, and he couldn't find him. He was completely gone. And let me back up. What he saw is, according to his account, is he was being dragged by a long serpentine arm wrapped around his legs, connected to a silver hovering disc in the air about 15 or 20 feet away. Lovett was pulled inside the craft. The major then stumbled back to his Jeep and went back to base. They sent security teams out to try to find Lovett after Cunningham had reported this, and they couldn't find his body. They couldn't find anything. 3 days later, a Lovett nude corpse was discovered 10 miles away from the site of the abduction. And from all indications, his body had been exposed to the elements for 24 to 48 hours. And the report offered no explanation of what could have accounted for the missing day. His tongue had been cut out from the lower portion of his jaw, just like in the Brazilian case. His eyes were gouged out and his anus removed, just like in the Brazilian case, and also like in, you know, bunches of cattle mutilation. In particular, the anus and the genitalia had been extracted almost like a plug, and his body had been completely drained of blood, completely exsanguinated. But there was no vascular collapse. So this is almost exactly like cattle mutilation. And something that's interesting in the Brazilian case is the victim's penis had been stretched and then bent to 90 degrees. And his testicles, his scrotum and testicles were removed.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So, you know, as scary and as horrifying as cattle and animal mutilations, you know, there are some rumors that there are human mutilations, which puts a whole kind of horrifying dynamic on the whole situation.
You know, when the first human mutilation was discovered, or when that might have been, was it early 50s?
This was,
I'm just interested if it correlates when the first human abduction by supposed ETs was, the most popular one was Betty and Barney Hill in 61.
This one, the Lovett and Cunningham case, was supposedly in 1956. And then the Brazilian case was 1990s, I believe. Yeah, see, 1988, September 1988. And it was a Billings Reservoir in São Paulo, Brazil.
That's really interesting. And what got me interested in these human mutilations was researching the Dyatlov Pass incident, where those hikers went up on that mountain and then they were all found, and pretty much exactly like human mutilations. Their tent was cut from the inside, they were missing their tongue, not very far away from the campsite, radiation spikes. So that's what really got me on the human mutilation side. What do you think of the Dyatlov Pass incident?
It's really interesting, because if you look at the Diablo Pass incident from the multiple optics you talked about, if we look at it from the animal mutilation optic, very similar injuries. There was some of the bodies, if I recall, were exsanguinated, had no blood in them. If you look at it from the human mutilation perspective, very similar, very similar. If you look at it from the, from the high strangeness perspective, you had radiation spikes, which is really strange. And then if you look at it from some of the studies of David Pilates, you had the same paradoxical undressing. Their clothes, in boots and all, weren't with them. And I've hiked and camped above the snow line before. And whatever is going on, you don't go out without your boots. You just don't, because it's basically a death sentence. And that, when I was doing some research also on the Dyatlov Pass incident, it reminded me of a case that David Pilates talked about, where a hunter was found 8 miles from his boots, and the terrain he had to travel over was scattered with a sharp scree and rocks, where a human would not have been able to traverse this distance on foot. Which brings me back to something that happened in the meadow. Is while we have the individual that turned into the sphere of light in the missing time, which happened almost at the exact same time, just about 30 minutes within one another, same individual, he showed us his GPS track the next day. And he always keeps his GPS running, and it drops breadcrumbs wherever he goes. And what was really interesting is his track line were a series of straight lines. And it showed him being on the other side of the small river, yet the guy was never wet. And the only way you can travel over this terrain at the meadow in a straight line is in the air. You can't do it on foot. It's too rugged. So more things to think about.
Yeah, I'm trying to look up the date of the Dyatlov Pass incident. It was, it looks like it was 1959.
Yep, that was almost the exact same time as the White Sands missile incident. And which is interesting, because White Sands missile, they were looking for remains of a rocket or a missile. And one of the accounts about the Dyatlov Pass is there was something to do with rocketry or a Soviet missile test. So that's just, I just realized that. That's kind of a strange coincidence there.
Yeah, there was a lot of theories that it could have been a military experiment during the Dyatlov Pass. And a lot of people have drawn conclusions that a lot of the cattle mutilations could be coming from the military. What's your thoughts on some of this phenomenon actually being of human origin, of some sort of military highly advanced technology?
Yeah, that that I kind of wonder about that, and I'll tell you why. My background is in government and military. That's kind of what I do. The Department of Defense has some very, very advanced labs and test facilities where they do stuff with animals. I'll just leave it at that. And why they would go to the trouble of going to a farmer's field, plucking a cow out of a field, doing something to it, and then dumping it back in the field when, Fort Meade or Fort Detrick, they have labs where they do that kind of stuff. And they have a, an animal that's been raised in controlled conditions. They know the animal's temperature. They know what it's been exposed to. They've done blood tests before. They know what the baseline is. They do whatever it is they do to it. And then they do a vivisection on the animal and look for whatever attributes they're looking for. And it's all done under controlled and tested environments. Picking a cow out of a field and throwing the detritus of your experiment right back out there, it's bad form. It doesn't make good sense to me. So, the military involvement, I don't see it from that perspective. Another way to look at that is there has been some correlation between UAP and high strangeness and military involvement. And that isn't just mere speculation. When Robert Bigelow owned Skinwalker Ranch there in the Uinta Valley, the NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Science, was contracted by the DIA under a special access program. And that's not speculation, that's fact. I read the book, Skinwalkers in the Pentagon, and looked at the way they described how this special access program was set up, how the budget was carved out, how the contract, and all of that rang very, very true to me from my professional experience. So we do know that the DIA and other elements of the government have a very strict and strong interest in these kind of phenomena. So it stands to reason that the military might be in the area where you have cattle mutilations or whatever. They might be there on the periphery of it, studying it, but they might not be the cause of it. So, correlation is not causation. There might be a correlation between animal mutilation military, but that doesn't mean the military caused it. They might just be researching it, studying it, taking measurements, and perhaps secretly, under the cover of darkness. So they might come in, take a measurement, do a study of a mutilation, and then get out real quick. And it might appear as though they were responsible for it, but they're just responding to it. That's all speculation. I don't have any direct knowledge of that, but that would make sense. That's how I would run an operation.
It does make a lot of sense. So we're being a intelligence officer in the military and being involved with the intelligence community as a whole, were you privy to any advanced technology that the military or any of these three-letter agencies could have been working on or might have been working on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am probably one of the few people that have worked in the defense industry, Department of Defense, and or the UK's Ministry of Defense that had absolutely no involvement in anything interesting like that. My stuff was all relatively boring. It's pretty, once again, oxymoron, but, pretty straightforward classified stuff, nothing earth-shattering. So I was never involved in any of the ATIP or anything like that. I was never involved in any programs prior to that, not involved in anything particularly interesting now. So no, it would be kind of cool if it was, and I wish I had an interesting story to tell you, but no, not really. I'm basically a paper pusher.
What about speculation, though? Do you have any speculation or theory that the military could possess? I mean, because we know that they have schematics, and a gentleman at the conference actually showed schematics and drawings from the military TR-3B, against the aerial phenomenon, right? So it's not a secret that they do have some kind of advanced technology, aerial anti-gravity craft.
I'll I'll tell you a story that's been declassified and is out there. F-117 Night Fighter. Okay. It popped into our collective consciousness during the first Gulf War in 1991. What a lot of people don't realize is the F-117 Nighthawk was an operational aircraft flying operational missions in an operational squadron at a Tampanaw testing facility since the 70s. So they actually kept the existence of that airframe, that triangular shaped airframe, secret from the late 70s to 1990. And it was flying operations. It was actually involved in the invasion of Grenada. People say the government can't keep a secret. I'm here to tell you, they can keep a secret. And DARPA, or now ARPA, they dropped the D off, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, has things they're working on that would seem like magic, that are that advanced, just crazy off the wall stuff. A stealth fighter in 1970? That was science fiction back then. The M1 Abrams tank, which just was in the news today because we're giving 31 of them to Ukraine, the most advanced main battle tank on the planet, was designed in the 60s. What are they working on in 2023? So, yeah.
They're revealing old technology, and they're passing it off as new. It's, it's obvious that's the case there. So you mentioned something that I hadn't heard of earlier, which was Project Grudge. Now, what agency or branch of the military was running that program? Do you know?
Yeah, Project Grudge was Air Force. It was the Air Force's, one of their first attempts to study back then UFOs. Because you had the Kenneth Arnold situation where he saw the flying saucers, back in the late 40s. You had the Roswell incident, and then people started reporting these things. And the Air Force, rightly so, decided to do a study to see, were these things a threat? What were they? Where did they come from? Can we detect them? And are they a threat? Now, it's interesting, you move into the 21st century, and ATIP was set up to do exactly the same thing. Is what are these? Are they a threat? Can we detect them? And can we defend against them? Can they enter our airspace without detection and completely without any kind of barriers? Can they move freely in our airspace? And what can we do about it? So, like I said, I was never directly involved in any of those programs, but it stands to reason that the Department of Defense never gave up its interest in UAPs. It just wouldn't make sense to me that they wouldn't have some sort of exploratory mechanism to track and categorize, catalog, and explore this phenomena.
It's really interesting, too. Do you have any information on Space Force and how long they might have had this, what would be kind of considered another branch of the Air Force, how long that program has been running? Because I'm utterly convinced that we've had a Space Force type of special access program for a really long time. And then when Trump came out and announced Air Force, they just rebranded it and made it public. So they changed the name to Space Force. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, that's nothing new. It's open source. I'm not going to release anything or disclose anything that isn't authorized. But you can look. The U.S. Army has the U.S. Army Aviation and Missile Command. The first missiles that we used were U.S. Army missiles built and studied under Von Braun at Redstone Arsenal in Alabama. That was a space program inside of the Army. The Army also has or had a space branch, U.S. Army Space Command. The Air Force also had a space command. You have other agencies that send things up in the sky for various reasons I'm not going to go into that also have their space operations. So space has always been another battlefield, if you will. It's always been another theater of operations. So this isn't anything new. I think it's just a way of taking you know, the Missile Defense Agency and all these different agencies that had a piece of the pie, putting them under one cohesive command so you don't have a duplication of effort. Like, it doesn't make sense to have, you know, back in the 60s, the U.S. Army studying missiles and the Air Force studying missiles. That did make sense. So now we have the Missile Defense Command that, you know, is a overall umbrella agency under Department of Defense. So I think it's a way of kind of focusing efforts. And quite frankly, it's a cost-saving measure, so you don't have the programs being duplicated with the same attributes and same capabilities.
I want to go where you don't really want to go, Trey, which is, do we have nukes in space? Do we have space armed with nuclear devices?
I have no knowledge of nuclear armed craft in space, be they satellites or manned craft. But nukes in space is nothing new. Back in the 60s, there were a series of experiments launched from, I believe, Christmas Island and Johnson's Atoll in the Pacific. And what they were actually doing is detonating nuclear weapons in space and watching their effects. One of the best examples of this, and this is open source, is something called Starfish Prime. Starfish Prime, I believe the craft was a Thor missile launched from Johnson Atoll, went up into the Pacific, detonated up in the stratosphere, and the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse, was so strong it caused light street lights in Honolulu to flicker, and they lost commercial radio communications for a few minutes. So, you know, nuclear weapons in space has been studied. Now, you know, are there weapons in space? That's not something I would be read into or I would have knowledge of. There have been a lot of proposals put out there. One was something called Rods from God, RODS, which were basically kinetic weapons like telephone poles that would be shot down out of satellites, and they would destroy a target using kinetic energy. So, you know, the concept of a offensive weapon being launched from space down to a target, you know, terra firma, is not a new concept. How that theory is being exercised today, or if it is, I have no knowledge.
Now, this is conjecture and hyperbole, because I don't think that there's public knowledge that there 100% is nuclear bombs in space that can be launched. It's speculation, but there was a project that was called Project Looking Glass in 1961, which was an Air Force project that armed what was a command post, a command center in space that was able to launch nukes from space from Earth, right? And in case that ground-based communications had been destroyed or rendered unusable. So, and this is really interesting too, because there's a quote from Lyndon B. Johnson to the Democratic Caucus of 1958, before he ran on the ticket with JFK, where he's talking about how space is the ultimate position, and that if you're in control of space, then you're in control of Earth, because from space, you can control the tides, you can control the weather, you can control the climate. It's basically a superposition, right? And then, you know, in 1961, we get that project of, you know, the Air Force arming space with nukes, right? So in your opinion, speculation, of course, why would we want to arm space? Why would we need to be in space and have a position or a command in space?
That's an excellent point. You know, military tactics, because you always hold the high ground. And, you know, as LBJ alluded to, space is the ultimate high ground. Let's look at this from a couple aspects. Back in the 60s, there was an Air Force program to take the Gemini program and develop something called the Aerial Research Laboratory, I think is what it was called. And I could be completely, and basically it was a surveillance platform in space. They were working on their Corona satellites and some of the other reconnaissance elements. And it was determined that it just didn't make sense. The capability was superseded by something else. No need to have a manned observation platform in space. Okay. So let's take that same thought and move it forward to your question about nuclear weapons. Is economy of scale. Okay, one thing that the U.S. military is, we're cheap. Okay, we don't want to spend a lot of money if we don't have to. If I can get the job done with a ball peen hammer, I'm not going to buy a sledgehammer. Economy of scale. So with some of the new, and this is conjecture on my part, I don't work in this part of it, but now you're starting to hear about hypersonic missiles. If I have a weapon that I can arm with conventional nuclear, whatever, and I can launch it from the ground, especially if I can launch it from a mobile platform, rail, truck, whatever, and it can achieve hypersonic speed and hit a target anywhere on Earth in 30 minutes, a nuke in space seems kind of superfluous. Why? Why would I spend the money for that? Why would I spend the money to maintain a platform in space when I don't have to? So I think looking at it from an economic standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I'm not omnipotent in that, so I don't really know. But it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, especially with some of the platforms we have here, you know, that are either already developed or are being developed.
Well, another interesting part of that speech that LGB was giving to the Democratic Caucus, sorry, I'm having a hard time with my words here apparently, is that at the end of that speech, he says that we need to win that superposition and hold it, right? Which the terminology there is really interesting to me, Trey, because winning something, and I was talking about this with Dr. Joseph Farrell the other day too, mm-hmm. winning something implies that there's an opposing force, mm-hmm. that there's something else out there or someone else out there that you need to win space from.
Right. That's a good observation. And, you know, I'm a little bit older than you. So I kind of have some really strong recollections of the Cold War. You know, I was born in the 60s. And the greatest existential threat, real no shit existential threat we had during the Cold War was Soviet nuclear weapons. And I remember as a kid living in Florida, we just went through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay. It was a real threat and people were really freaked out about it. And there was a lot of back and forth on how did we defend against it. A lot of people don't know that this, but actually on the coastal United States, the U.S. Army had something called Nike missile bases and Nike missile batteries. And these were missiles that were equipped with nuclear warheads that were anti-missile missiles. They would shoot these up, detonate a nuclear blast in the sky that would scramble the electronics of incoming missiles. So it was a very real existential threat. You also had the U.S. versus the Soviets in the space race, going all the way back to Sputnik, Explorer, Latka the Space Dog, you know, Miss Abel, the monkey in space, and then, of course, Yuri Gagarin, first man in space, John Glenn, et cetera, et cetera. So it was this constant one-upmanship, not only for propaganda purposes. You know, we put the first person in space, you know, our astronaut ate the first Snickers bar in space or whatever, but it was also military, because the early rockets that the U.S. was using to launch astronauts in space were military rockets. The rockets the Soviets were launching into space, their cosmonauts, were ballistic missile rockets, you know, used for nuclear weapons. So there was a very strong military edge to it too. So it was continually one-upmanship. Lyndon B. Johnson earned his political spurs right in the middle of this. Okay, he was the vice president, assumed the presidency after the assassination of JFK. And there's a whole lot I can, you know, people can go into on the assassination of JFK. And that's a whole other, you know, discussion. But there were a lot of people that believed that that might have been a Soviet operation. And so the Soviets were a very real threat, not only a abstract threat, but after what they just went through with the Cuban Missile Crisis and the assassination, a very visceral, a very personal threat. So I think it's reasonable that LBJ was actually referring to the Soviets as that existential threat. And, you know, one thing in the military, we talk about a 25-meter target, 50-meter target, 100-meter target. The 25-meter target is the target that's getting ready to hit you right now. That's the one you address first. Then once you get that taken care of, then you address your 50-meter target, and then later on your 100-meter target. So the Soviets were the 25-meter target back during the Cold War. And I would like to say that the Cold War is over. I was an intel officer during the Cold War, and what we're going through right now looks real familiar to me. You know, I think I've been here, done that, got that T-shirt from Fort Huachuca, the U.S. Army's Intelligence Center. So I can't say that the Cold War is necessarily over, but I think maybe now we're starting to, you know, move our focus to maybe more esoteric threats, if you will, maybe non-terrestrial threats, or maybe even determinant that they are threats. We just know something's going on. Something is able to enter our airspace at will. We know that something is able to outfly the most advanced airframes on the planet, as we saw with the Go Fast, the Gimbal, and the Tic Tac videos. You know, they were outflying our F-18 fighters. Our trans medium, they can go into water, out of water, they can disappear, reappear, do things that we can't. So now I think maybe the focus is starting to go back to that, like it was maybe during the Project Grudge and Project Blue Book. And it's really neat to see that I'm starting to see disclosure in my lifetime. You know, I'm 58, I've got less years ahead of me than I do behind me. But I'm actually seeing this, and I'm seeing the Department of Defense and other agencies acknowledge that there's something out there. And I think that's kind of cool.
The only problem that I have with that, Trey, is that it seems like it's too little too late. That they've waited too long to come out and say, oh yeah, these UFOs and these things that people are seeing are actually real, right? So it seems like a really forced agenda, right?
It's done for a reason. I mean, it's done for a reason, and there are several ways to look at that. One thing that in the classification of information, which obviously is hot in the news right now, that's actually something I have a lot of experience with, on how you classify things and mark them and protect them and all of that, is once something can no longer be held secret and it has so much inertia, you disclose it. Or you declassify it very quietly and don't mention it. You just remove the protective markings off of it. Kind of like we were talking about before the show, some of the Grill Flame and Stargate data, which is now declassified by the CIA. It wasn't a big public release when that was declassified. It was just very quietly. You move to the public side of the CIA's archives. Now it's out there. If you know where to look, you know, that whole treasure trove of data. So, you know, there are a lot of really good researchers out there that are digging through information, sending out FOIA requests, trying to get to the bottom of this. And, you know, we're never going to have all the information. You know, even people in the business, you know, we're never going to have all the information. Certain parts of it are going to be compartmentalized. I'm just happy that I can now say, hey, folks, I'm not full of crap. These things are real. And I can prove it to you because the Department of Defense and the U.S. government has basically admitted it, albeit grudgingly, partially, and not in a complete manner. But, you know, they have admitted it.
I'm glad you brought up Grill Flame and Sunstreak and the Stargate Project, because that's something that I want to get into with you before I let you go here this evening. Have you looked into that? Have you looked into the Army intelligence and the DIA studying psychics, remote viewers, telekinesis, channeling? Mm-hmm. I think some of the programs even had channelers and mystics in them. I've been digging into this really hardcore and deep mm-hmm. here lately, and interviewed. I've been trying to get in contact with more people that's officially been involved with the program. But have you been involved with any sort of remote viewing projects within the military, outside of the military, yeah, or wherever?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you mentioned remote viewing. When I was a young man in college. I was in ROTC. I went to university on an Army scholarship. And the university I attended was the University of West Georgia, which has a really well-known parapsychology department. Dr. William Roll was one of the professors. And when my professors found out that I was going to be branched Army intelligence, they would come up to me and they'd wink and they'd say, yeah, you're going to end up at SRI. William Roll was one of the people that worked with Ingo Swann, you know, and some of the early remote viewers. So, you know, they were kind of teasing me that I was going to go into that side of things with a degree from that university. Strangely enough, I didn't. You know, I went into counterintelligence, so I didn't have anything to do with that. But later on, I met a gentleman who is, he's very low key, but he's trained some international well-known remote viewers. You know, he's known in the community. And he and I were corresponding on something, and he was doing a remote viewing course for very select people. And it was over the course of one summer. It was free. You know, I didn't have to pay for it. And we learned military coordinate remote viewing. So I am a trained remote viewer. I don't do it as much as I should. You know, it's really takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of effort to stay current. And I can, you know, talk about the ins and outs of coordinate remote viewing, you know, if you want to, but it takes a lot of effort, and I haven't kept up with it. I do know some very good, talented remote viewers that, you know, do a lot of remote viewing today. But what's interesting is INSCOM, U.S. Army's Intelligence and Security Command, had a commander by the name of General Bert Stubblebine. And General Stubblebine was very forward-looking, and he was one of these guys that was kind of, what the hell, let's try it. And in the intelligence business is you look for corroborating data from multiple sources and multiple disciplines. You have ELINT, which is electronic intelligence, which is the emanation of frequencies. You know, certain things give off certain frequencies, okay? You have imagery intelligence, IMINT, photograph of something. So if I have a frequency given off by a certain radar associated with a certain missile system and now I have a photograph of it, these are two different disciplines corroborating one another. So he said, well, you know, I'm reading about the Soviets doing these experiments with psychic spies. The U.S. Army needs to get involved in this. So the Intelligence and Security Command set up a program, and I believe the first compartmentalization was Grill Flame. I could be off on that. And they started looking at remote viewing, and they got with the Stanford Research Institute, SRI, and they came up with a protocol called coordinate remote viewing. And the weird thing about CRV is it's very structured, and you're so focused on the structure that you open up the liminal part of your mind. And it's kind of hard to explain and articulate, but you're so focused on the structure and the protocol that you allow the part of your mind to kind of start flowing freely, as the you know, the left-hand side of your brain is focused on staying in the protocol and filling out these matrices and all of that. And doggone it, it works. You know, they started seeing in simulated targets and actual intelligence targets results. There was a general, I'm trying to remember. It was a kidnapping, I want to say the Red Brigade in Italy. Might have been General Dozier. I can't remember. And remote viewing was used to help get an idea of what the room he was in looked like before the special operations forces went in and freed him. So, you know, it's just another tool in the intelligence toolbox. Looking at the record of successes, you know, I'm talking about percentages of accuracy done by the SRI experiments. The military and the government will say, we no longer use remote viewers. That's their policy. I have never been involved in remote viewing in the military. But if you have something that's even a little bit helpful in the intelligence world, you're going to use it because you're looking at it as a corroboration on other means of collection.
Absolutely. I agree with that statement so much. And I think that they found a different usage or a different purpose for the remote viewers. It didn't become, it turned into something different other than just collecting intelligence data, right?
Yeah.
And almost everyone that I've talked to about it agrees with me with that, though there is, zero proof. So speculation. What do you think that the purpose for a remote viewer would be now? Like, what would that program have turned into? Because it's evolved a lot, you know, it went from just studying it and went to SRI. It was studied in the MK Ultra programs in the early 50s. Then it became funded by the intelligence communities through SRI. And then it became an Army intelligence program. And then it became a special access program in 1979, run by the DIA. So it's done. It's gone a lot of evolving over the years. And then it was shut down in 95. Right.
Right.
The CIA, it was supposed to be handed back to the CIA. And then the CIA was like, we haven't, the remote viewing hasn't given us any valuable intelligence, which is a lie. Obviously, it's a lie. So what do you think the purpose of it would be now? What would they be using that for now?
Now, this from my personal experience in training is we were trained to do things and this is going to sound hokey, but you're just going to have to take my word for something called a deep mind probe, where you can actually take a target who's a person and you can get inside of what they're thinking and seeing. And you can pick up emotions. You can pick up what they're hearing, what they're tasting, what they're feeling. You can pick up the very primal instincts that they're feeling, fight, flight or fight. You can also go and move back in time and sometimes forward in time. Because the theory is on a quantum scale, everything that ever was, that is, or will be exists in one state. And you can tap into that state using remote viewing. And you're nodding like you've heard all this before. So a tool like that, for a really, really talented person would just be invaluable. Think about a practitioner who has these skills that has sharpened them to a razor's edge that can do that. What can they be used for? They can be used for a lot of good, and they can also be used for a lot of bad. And the crazy thing is, anybody can do it. There's nothing magical about remote viewing. Anybody can do it. It just takes training and discipline. Everybody has that ability. I am about as intuitive as a banana slug. And I can remote view. So that's proof in the pudding right there.
I'm going to take it one step further. I like your thought and your idea about the probing, getting inside someone's mind. But if you can get in somebody's mind, Trey, could you plant thoughts, ideas, beliefs into their head, into their brain, make them do something that they normally wouldn't do?
That's a good point. That is a good point. And I'm trying to remember where in my library I have it. It's somewhere. There's some documents from the Chinese that were actually teaching some of their intelligence personnel to detect when somebody was trying to RV into them in ways to defend against it. So, the psyche is a very delicate thing. It's very robust, but it's also very delicate. So, mind control, who knows? It would be a heck of a tool, wouldn't it?
That's my exact thoughts. And I'm glad we got to talk about that, because it's very few people I've actually got to, explain my, theory to, especially, people that are actively involved in the intelligence community today. Paul Smith hated that theory. He didn't like it at all. And it was unfortunate that he didn't like it, because I think that it's very plausible, right? If you can remote view, why would you not be able to also influence with your remote viewing? Why would you not be able to transfer? I mean, we know how energy works. Energy is, people can you can walk into a room and be down and depressed, and that brings the entire energy down of the room. And how affirmations work too, right? Affirmations, you say affirmations to yourself, it boosts you up, makes you feel good. So why couldn't you project that same affirmation out to somebody else, right? With your mind, right, using remote viewing, right? It makes sense to me, but yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's an interesting theory. I, of course, was never trained in anything like that, but who knows? You know, there is more to heaven and earth than in your books, Horatio, as Shakespeare said.
Well, thanks so much, Trey. I appreciate your time this evening. Love the conversation. It was wonderful to have you on again. Let people know where they can find you online or purchase your book. I bought your book at the conference, but I don't have it with me right now.
That's okay. Where can you find me? If you go behind the closest liquor store and look for a pair of feet sticking out from under a cardboard box, that's usually me. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding, of course. The best way is I don't do Twitter. And I actually, I don't know if you know David Altman. He was saying, why don't you have a Twitter account, Trey? And I'm like, I don't want to get involved in all of that drama. So I don't have Twitter. I do have Facebook, however. So you can go to TreyHudson-author. I'm on Facebook there. And you know, if I have time and I see a message pop up, usually I try to respond to people. My book is The Meadow Project, Explorations into the South Skinwalker Ranch. You can find that on Amazon. Just type my name into it. Hey, if you parlez vous français, we just published it in French. So it's going to hit the European market here pretty soon. We've got it in ebook, audiobook, hardcover, and softcover, however you want. I've actually started working on notes for a second book. So my publisher is beating me about the head and neck to get that out. So I hope to have that out in the next year or so. And so there I am.
Thanks so much, Trey. I appreciate you a lot. All the links to Trey's information will be in the description of this video. I highly recommend it. A wonderful book. Get you hooked in immediately. For everyone else, thanks for watching and listening. Much love to you, everyone in the chat. Please be sure to hit the thumbs up button to help the channel out in the YouTube algorithm. Share, subscribe, hit the bell icon as well for notifications. The links to all of my information is also in the description. And remember, we're not only in a spiritual war, but a war on humanity. Stay aware, stay alert, keep love in your heart for everyone. Stay safe out there. And if you can see through the illusion, you are the solution. See you guys next time.